Today is Thursday, January 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Congo's Electoral Commission announces a winner in the nation's controversial presidential election.
Some people think that since they found in Fayulu the chosen candidate, the selected candidate from the opposition, it might go to and contest the result.
The U.S. government shutdown continues as Democrats refuse to give in to the president's demand for border wall funding.
We have a better idea of how to keep our country safe.
And one of the richest couples in the world have announced they're getting a divorce. It's all on today's International Edition. The Electoral Commission in the Democratic Republic of Congo has announced a winner in the presidential election as the country braces for possible protests over alleged rigging 10 days after the contentious, repeatedly delayed general election. The vast country voted on December 30th for a successor to President Joseph Kabila, who has ruled since 2001. The opposition and activist groups have warned of protests if the results do not match the truth of the ballot boxes. VOA French to Africa journalist Eddie Isango joins us with the latest. Thank you so much for being with us with this breaking news update. What are we learning about who they're saying is the winner? An election on December 30th that's been roiled with turmoil. It looks like there are tentative results finally coming out from Congo's Election Commission. What do we know?
Finally, the Electoral Commission, the National Electoral Commission, independent, just proclaimed that Félix Tshisekedi won with over 38% of the voters. It was this night after a long time, and this election, as we know, has been postponed so many times.
What do we know about this person that just won, that they've been declaring the winner? Do we know much about him? I know there were many candidates.
Of course, there were many candidates. Before talking about other candidates, let me talk about Félix Tshisekedi. He is the head of the UDPS, that is one of the major, if not the major, party in Congo. In fact, he is the son of his father, Etienne Tshisekedi, who is well-known, a long-time opponent, even since Mobutu, the former president who was expelled by Laurent Désiré Kabila. And his father passed away, died last year. Then he took over the party and then leading it. But let's say this election was challenging. So much I'm not talking just about difficulties, but in the opposition we had two main opponents. There was another one whose name is Martin Fayulu, and there was also one candidate from the former ruling party of the president Joseph Kabila.
Are we bracing for possible protests over alleged rigging for this result?
I believe so, because most of people think that the other opponent win, but you know, now the election, I don't know, was it fair or not? Many people, many organizations like the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, and many other organizations called for the truth in the election. And maybe they will accept this. If they don't accept, then we have a protest other side of the opposition.
It sounds like he was the leading candidate, but opposition candidate Martin Fayulu, who led in the polling, has been warning against election manipulation. Do you think he might contest the results?
Of course, I think he might contest the elections, because you know, people sometimes just base themselves from what they see during the campaign. I would say that Martin Fayulu was like a candidate of the surprise, because he was leading one of part of the opposition. But when they went before the election to a meeting to try to find a joint candidate, it was him that was chosen by other candidates, among them including Félix Tshisekedi. But just less than a day after, Félix Tshisekedi and Vital Kamerhe, who was also another candidate, they removed themselves from this agreement. But this played to, let's say, divide the opposition, and that's why some people think that since they found in Fayulu the chosen candidate, the selected candidate from the opposition, he might go and contest the results.
Right, and I know there are Constitutional Court has 14 days to validate the results, so that's 2 weeks that we could see who knows how much turmoil. Ultimately, do you think whatever the results are, when they're validated, people will accept it?
Maybe not. You know, as a journalist, I cannot say that I have verified that. But there has been, around in the media in Congo, the media reports a deal between Félix Tshisekedi and the former government. So some people think that this election or this result is rather the result of this deal than the real result. But that's what some media say in Congo. But it might also reflect the real result. Let's see how things will go and if they will accept or not.
That's VOA French to Africa journalist Eddie Isongo. Thanks for being with us. The economic livelihoods of some 800,000 federal workers hang in the balance as President Donald Trump and Democrats remain at odds over the president's demand for a border wall with Mexico. It's a split that has pushed a partial government shutdown now into its third week. Trump said he quickly ended a meeting on Wednesday between both sides after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi indicated that Democrats wouldn't fund his wall under any circumstances. Vice President Mike Pence, who was in the abbreviated meeting, blamed Democrats, who he says are not willing to compromise.
He asked Speaker Pelosi that if he opened things up quickly, if he reopened the government quickly, would she be willing to agree to funding for a wall or a barrier on the southern border? And when she said no, the president said goodbye.
But Pelosi telling reporters the president walked out without trying to even look for a resolution.
And so I said to him, Mr. President, the evidence of what's happening there does not support the crisis that you describe, and therefore the solution you suggest, because we have a better idea of how to keep our country safe, and it isn't a wall.
As a third government shutdown of President Trump's tenure stretched into its 19th day, political pressures on Trump and the Democrats have left little room for compromise in the standoff over funding the wall. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the politics motivating both sides in the shutdown dispute.
Donald Trump fueled his rise to the presidency with a campaign promise to build a border wall that Mexico would pay for. Trump is now under pressure from conservatives to follow through, says analyst Larry Sabato.
Essentially, they said, if you don't push harder for your wall and you don't get billions of dollars to build it, then your base, and we represent that base, won't be there for you in 2020.
Immigration is also a touchstone for opposition Democrats, who morally oppose the border wall and the president's overall hardline approach, says Sabato.
It's about the treatment of immigrants at the borders. It's about the separation of families. This is a human rights issue. It isn't just about border security.
Okay, anymore?
Confronted with historically weak poll ratings 2 years into his term, Trump seems primarily focused on pleasing his base. But that is a risky strategy, says historian Doris Kearns Goodwin.
I haven't seen President Trump move from a campaigning mode to a governing mode.
And the base seems to have a magical relationship with him in his mind. And somehow he hasn't tried to move well beyond that. He just simply wants to make sure he doesn't lose them.
Trump believes his path to re-election lies along a border wall that has yet to become a reality.
We can and we will.
Democrats, including many of those preparing to run for president next year, seem equally determined to deny him a political victory just as the 2020 campaign is about to begin. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the looming question is whether the impact of the shutdown on government services and the plight of struggling federal workers force Republican lawmakers to break from the president or compel Democrats to budge. Trump's focus now squarely on his conservative base and its support for the wall that came to symbolize Trump's promise for a hardline, unrelenting approach to immigration. He's also continuing to make the argument that this is imperative to national security. He outlined an argument in graphic terms during a primetime Oval Office address Tuesday night. While several studies suggest that illegal immigration has no impact on crime rates, the president highlighted horrific crimes committed by immigrants and suggested his wall was needed to prevent this, quote, crisis. Joining us to discuss that part of the story is Robert Deitz with the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He's a former general counsel for the U.S. National Intelligence Agency. Sir, some analysts are suggesting or starting to say that while the president calls it a national security crisis, the shutdown is creating somewhat of a national security crisis or has the potential to do so. Do you agree?
In my experience in the intel community, the question is always who is, you know, necessary, and it's very difficult in the intel world to say, now don't worry about this part of the world. Nothing is going to happen there. And so it is worrisome. It is definitely worrisome. You may recall a number of years ago, the intel world completely missed a nuclear bomb test conducted by the Indians. And we didn't know anything about it. That's the kind of thing that could happen with a government shutdown.
We've got TSA workers that are handling security at airports that are calling out sick. We've got the FBI working without pay, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security. I'm surprised that no one has asked the president about that, considering he's saying this is such a big national security issue.
Well, bear in mind that the president is not terribly consistent, and so I think that that explains part of it. He's also, in order to make the case for the Pentagon doing construction, he's got to hype up the national security emergency that would justify that step. And so you can't have it both ways. If you think that this is a national security emergency, you've got to make that case.
Where do you see this going? Because it looks like a pretty big standoff here between the president, who wants this wall and doesn't seem to want to discuss anything unless he's guaranteed he'll get a wall, and Democrats saying, look, we can discuss national security, we can discuss border security. Once we reopen the government, that has to be the priority.
Right.
We're not going to start haggling over border issues that are just too big to deal with this quickly when we have, you know, people not getting paid.
Right. You know, if I had to guess, and this is nothing but a guess, I think that he's going to lose his Republican following because, you know, it turns out one of the ironies is that Mr. Trump's faithful tend to be rural folks. And as you know, a program has been created to allow assistance to agricultural communities that are affected by tariff problems with China. But according to the radio this morning, there are no Department of Agriculture people who can take the applications and adjudicate them. So I think that could end up being a substantial problem for the president.
How long do you think this could go on?
Well, it's really almost, it reminds me just a little bit of the old games that teenagers used to play called chicken. Who's gonna blink? And I think that right now Pelosi's got the bigger hand, because as much as Trump has tried to pin this on the Democrats, he could not ignore the fact that he welcomed a shutdown. And so I think that Pelosi's got the stronger hand.
But how long can the government function?
That's a great question.
I mean, we have people that aren't getting food stamps. We have, you know, government workers that aren't able to buy groceries and pay their bills. So how long can something like this last without really just doing detrimental damage to the U.S. economy?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because in the early days, weeks of a shutdown, the cost is pretty marginal. I mean, people will take money out of their bank account in order to buy groceries or talk to their parents or something. But once it gets going, it is going to do substantial damage, and it's not that easy to turn it around.
All right, that is Robert Dice, professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Meanwhile, outside of Washington, the shutdown has curbed enjoyment of public lands. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is directing dozens of wildlife refuges to return staffers to work to make sure hunters and others have access despite the shutdown, according to an email by the Associated Press, obtained by the Associated Press. Wildlife groups complained that the Trump administration was trying to minimize the public impact to limit political blowback for the president. The Trump administration's Justice Department is about to see another departure of a key official. AP correspondent Matt Small tells us that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is expected to step down.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein is anticipated to leave the Justice Department, where he's been overseeing the day-to-day operations of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Soon after William Barr is confirmed as Attorney General, once confirmed, Barr would assume oversight of that probe. It isn't unusual for attorneys general and other cabinet secretaries to have their own deputies. Matt Small, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The myths and realities of climate change. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo meets with top Iraqi officials during an unannounced visit to Baghdad. The U.N. is alarmed at uprooting of civilians in Nigeria's war with militants. And new Brazil government drops diversity from school books. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, now we turn to Southeast Asia. In what has been well documented to the media, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have been forced from their homes in Myanmar after suffering murderous attacks, rapes, and destruction of their homes, and have fled to neighboring Bangladesh. But now, over the past few weeks, what hasn't been reported much in the headlines is the renewed violence taking place in Myanmar's Rakhine State, the same area where the Rohingya community lived, and this time targeting another religious group. Deborah Eisenman, managing director of the Asia Society Policy Institute, talks about what's happening with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
What's happening now is that the Tatmadaw, Myanmar's military, and the Arakan army in Rakhine State have been having skirmishes for the past about month. And over the weekend, on Myanmar's Independence Day, the Arakan army launched an attack against four police posts, killing 13 policemen and wounding nine. This, in turn, has now caused the Myanmar military to say that they will crush the Arakan army and to really renew calls for violence in a region that's already been so deeply affected by conflict.
Now, are these people who make up the Arakan army, are they Rohingya?
No. So the Arakan army is comprised of Rakhine Buddhists. It's completely separate from the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, for instance, which was considered a terrorist group by the military and by Myanmar's government, which is a Rohingya-focused organization. The Arakan army is focused on rights for Rakhine Buddhists.
And what is their beef with the Myanmar army?
Well, you know, ethnic conflict in Myanmar is going on 70 years strong now, so all of these beefs are actually quite well baked and have been going on for quite a long time. The Arakan Army is a relatively new ethnic armed group. it's been around for about the past 10 years, trained by actually the Kachin Independence Army. And the Arakan Army is really, you know, looking for territory and representation for their people. They're looking for both a federalist model, but also just having, autonomy as Rakhine State.
Is there an incident that has sparked this latest outbreak?
Well, there have been a few. So, you know, throughout the country, and this has been happening obviously for the past 70 years, but also an escalation just over the past year or two. You know, you see these skirmishes, these exchanging of fire over perceived slights based on one army stepping on the other's perceived territory and those things. And so that's what's been happening over the past month with smaller scale kind of conflicts and smaller scale displacement of local civilians. What's happened now, though, over the weekend is a much larger scale attack by the Arakan Army, which will now in turn get a disproportionately large attack by the Tatmadaw.
Now, if this is not a religious dispute, what is it?
It's not a religious dispute. It's really a territorial and political dispute, quite frankly, but waged by an insurgent army.
Is there any evidence that any other country in the world might be involved in this?
Clear evidence, no. It's certainly plausible that, money comes through back channels from other countries, or that the Arakan Army might have some armaments or have some folks across another border, but there's no direct line to China or India or Bangladesh or others of Myanmar's neighbors that could point to it and say, you know, you're behind something quite nefarious here.
Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi has borne, as you know, much of the ire of the world about how she has handled the Rohingya crisis. Now some reports say she has made some incendiary remarks about this latest conflict. In fact, there was a remark that you brought up earlier in our talk here.
Yes, you know, there's been some conversation that seems to be coming from her office, both saying that we have to crush the insurgency. The spokesperson for the president has also made some attempts to liken the Arakan Army to the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army and say there are ties there. All of this is, you know, the ties are unclear, and in terms of what Aung San Suu Kyi and the government does, you know, the Arakan Army hasn't been welcomed into the peace process. So some of this is political, and some of this is obviously military.
That's Deborah Eisenman, Managing Director of the Asia Society Policy Institute. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Cameroon's top female football star has opened an academy to teach the sport to girls. The academy is the first of its kind in Cameroon, where football is still largely considered a boys' sport. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports on the Rails Football Academy in Yaoundé.
Le physique, c'est la confiance en soi.
Cameroon women's footballer Raissa Fedjou urges a group of 80 girls aged 5 to 16 to have the confidence to become professional players. Nicknamed the Indomitable Lioness, Fedjou is helping to drill the young footballers at Yaoundé's Amadou Ahidjo Stadium. They are hoping to be selected to join the Rails Football Academy, the first in Cameroon for girls, which opens on January 4. Fedja says they must be ready even to play against male football stars like Cameroon striker Samuel Eto'o or the French national team's Kylian Mbappé. Among the girls who travelled from all over Cameroon for tryouts is 16-year-old Christine Wautier from the western town of Chang.
I'm there because we have heard about the academy created by the international football player called Engana Mudgael. We are there because we try our best to be like her. You have the opportunity to be an international. Maybe if we are selected, we can stay there and work hard to be like her.
Gael Enganamut, a 27-year-old football star, never had any formal training. But she says having a football academy for girls will develop Cameroon's female players into world stars.
The foundation have an objective to promote women football so we can see the impact. In 2016 here with the African Cup, I was so impressed. I say I have opportunity to open this foundation. I can do it.
As a young girl, Engana Moit had an early passion for football. Her family rejected her love of the game because football was considered a boy's sport. But Engana Moit's determination took her to play not only at the national level, but also with a Norwegian club. Gislaine Beben, one of the coaches selecting players for the academy, says most of the girls show talent.
I was surprised today and I'm very happy because I train with my young sister and all that girls have good talent. So I think when the guy put that that academy, I think that that girl will receive a good good formation and they're going to have good talent.
Rails Football Academy manager Frank Happy says they will choose 18 players for each age category. He says they have prepared a training program that does not clash the girls' academic progress. Formal education, he says, will be vital not only in the girls' lives, but also to their careers as professional players. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and his wife, one of the wealthiest couples in America, have announced they're getting a divorce. AP correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos say they are divorcing after 25 years. Their marriage played a role in the creation of the online behemoth that made him the world's wealthiest person. The couple met while they were working at a New York City hedge fund and married 6 months later. While she drove them across country to Seattle, he sketched out the business plan that became Amazon, starting as an online bookseller, evolving into a retailer of almost everything, as well as a data giant. Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos say they will remain cherished friends, according to their announcement. It is silent on how they'll divide up the estimated $137 billion fortune. I'm Warren Levinson.
It's been 24 hours, I need more hours with you.
Cardi B has 13 reasons to celebrate. She has been nominated for 13 honors at the 2019 iHeartRadio Music Awards. iHeartMedia announced Wednesday the rapper's most nominated act, competing for honors such as Song of the Year for Girls Like You with Maroon 5 and Female Artist of the Year. Drake follows Cardi B with 8 nominations and is up for Song of the Year with God's Plan. The iHeart Awards will make its debut on Fox when it airs live March 14th from the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. Ariana Grande earned 6 nominations, while J Balvin, Maroon 5, Post Malone, and Marshmello each scored 5 nominations. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. We spent the day like-
trying to make things right between us.